Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We are here at the Conservative Political Action Conference. We're taping interviews with some of its very prominent and important contributors as well as guests, one of whom is Zhi Van Fleet, a woman I've come to know and admire greatly since she emerged in my home county of Loudoun, Virginia, to address with the school board there the problems, well, the outrages associated with the embrace by the school board of critical race theory, something she properly understood to be a Marxist doctrine aimed at, well, taking down our country. We've had a chance to talk with her on any number of occasions. She's contributed to our Committee on the Present Danger of China webinar series, and she's a marvelous friend as well as a great resource. And we're very pleased to catch up with her here at CPAC. Zhi Van Fleet, glad you're here, and thank you for finding a few minutes to talk
with
us.
Thank you for finding me and bringing me here.
Happy to do it. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about your personal experience in communist China with what was called the Cultural Revolution and why you have been warning in our country that something very similar is afoot now.
Absolutely. The same thing's happening. I just had an interview earlier today, and someone said that I saw the movie before, and now it's playing here. I said, no, I did not see the movie before. I was in the movie before. Yes, I was. So why I'm passionate about it? Because it's been replayed right here in front of us in America. And people say, but is this the same thing? I said it is the same thing for people who know history. And who people not just know history, but experience history. Why there's so many people still don't see it here? That is our problem. People do not know. Why they don't know? It's never taught in school. The publics were never taught what communism is. That is our biggest challenge, that people can't see the wokeness, equity, all this, diversity, sustainability, they're all different versions of the same thing that I experienced in China.
Now, there is a difference, and as I understand it, Mao focused on class warfare. Mm-hmm. And in our country, the focus of these cultural Marxists, foreign, I think it's fair to say, the Chinese Communist Party is certainly promoting this, but also domestic. The enemies within, I think of them as, they're using race as a means of fracturing us, dividing us from one another, and taking us down. Is that right?
Yeah, to me, I think it's very important to see that this is only part of the whole scheme. They have to divide people before they can take over a society, a culture, a civilization. So in China, they use class, and here they use race, but it went way beyond race. Identity. Identity politics. Identity can be something we inherited. We're born that way, right? You can also create identity. And that's what left has been doing. And create all sorts of identity. And even being an immigrant.
Genders.
Everything. Even immigrant.
Yes.
Being an immigrant in the intersectionality, I'm just more depressed than you because you're a natural born citizen. Gender. Trans is their gold mine because trans is trans reality. You can create endless identity. And why you want that? You claim victim and you become their side. And that is all about division. Once it's once the nation is divided and then you sit them against each other and then you are on your way to destroy this nation.
Yes. You mentioned that I'm a natural-born citizen. One of the things I love about you, Zhi Van Fleet, is you are a foreign-born American patriot. And I think what's so incalculably important about your voice and what you're bringing to the fore is you have this appreciation of how perishable freedom is. it is not foreordained that we will always enjoy it, let alone that our children or our children's children were. And again, you've been in that movie. You know what it's like.
The problems with Americans, again, I said, it's education. Education is the root of most of our problems because people don't understand. When they talk about the freedom, they have no reference point. They're talking about, I want freedom to express myself and I want to dress certain way, I want to be certain way, claim myself, identity, whatever way. And they have no idea what it is when you have no freedom. Because they always have it, they push it in a way that freedom is being abused. And I tell those people, you can have your party until the radicals have control of the power. Then you can be what you want to be. You can only be one way, the way they want you to be.
Yes.
I was
dead.
There.
Or dead.
Yes,
that's
or
the,
dead.
That's
or
the
dead.
Other option.
If you resist,
yeah.
Dead.
Yeah. Xi Van Fleet, when you go around the country speaking about these issues, I know you obviously come under attack from the left. You have been engaged in a Twitter war of late with this New York Times reporter who conjured up the whole 1619 project, for example. Talk a little bit about, that as an example of the enemy within.
Absolutely.
At work and the effort to silence you from being heard.
Not only silence me, I want to say that is a perfect example of what happened in the Cultural Revolution and in Mao's China. They rewrote history. I, along with millions of children, were taught fake history, fictional history, and it was cooked up by the CCP. And that's what Nicole Hannah-Jones is doing here. She's the one that rewrite history so that, okay.
So in China, the role.
To play into, again, this idea that we're a systemically racist country, always have been. There won't be any getting out from under it, right?
I wanted to warn people, when history repeats itself, it's not exact. But you know history, you can see it through. In China, they rewrote history to tell us that the CCP is our savior. They are our liberator, and we should be grateful and obey them. And what they're doing here is they rewrote history to condemn this country. Why? They want to overthrow. They want to destroy this country to build something that's 100%. Tyrannic.
Well, that will be a colony or a vassal state or populated
exactly.
by the Chinese
exactly.
Communist Party's people. Xi, one of the other things that's so important about your efforts with the school board and focusing on education, I think of it as diseducation,
yes.
really,
yeah.
Is the angle of attack that, as you know, is central to the Marxist doctrine, namely trying to take down the family.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about your experiences there. We've got just a minute left. In your own family and what is being done to ours.
Yeah. To take down a society, the easiest way is to take down the building blocks of a society, which is family. In China, we were taught that we do not belong to our parents. We belong to the party because the party were our real parents and we have songs that we sing. And that's why during the Cultural Revolution, children turned against the parents in defense of Mao. And the children reported their parents and some ended up losing their lives. And that happened a lot during the Cultural Revolution. And that's what they want us to do here. They separate the children from parents. They turn the children against the parents. And now we heard stories of children report their parents, so their parents now end up in jail. History is repeated.
And it will take down our country if they're successful. Xi Van Fleet, thank you for your leadership. You are an extraordinary foreign-born American patriot. We prize our relationship with you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Come back
thank
to
you.
Us soon. We'll be right back with more on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We're still doing the Lord's work, I like to think, at the Conservative Political Action Conference by finding and bringing to you some of the best people that we work with and know and highly regard. And certainly all of that is true of our next guest. Her name is Reggie Littlejohn. She is the founder and president of a wonderful human rights organization called Women's Rights Without Frontiers. She's also a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, colleague who co-chairs with me the jointly sponsored Stop Vaccine Passports Task Force, which has been doing, under her leadership particularly, really incalculably important work exposing what we are facing in the form of these vaccine mandates and the digital documentation that establishes whether you have conformed to the mandate or not. We're delighted to have a chance to talk with her about all of that. Reggie, welcome, and so great to be able to do this in person. We usually talk to you at a remove, but you're here at CPAC. Thank you for taking some time to talk with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank. It's great to be here.
Thank you. So, Reggie, you have been raising the alarm now for some time through these task force webinars, and you can find them at stopvaxpassports.org. Specifically about what you call the digital gulag. I want you to talk us through what that refers to and how close we are to finding ourselves confined in it.
Right. So, first of all, we are very close to being confined in it. So, this is something that people really need to understand. The digital gulag is combination of any digital ID. So it could be a vaccine passport, it could be a smart health card, it could be a digital driver's license. Any mandatory digital ID can support the platform of China's social credit system, which is it's a tool of mass surveillance and totalitarian control in which every single aspect of a person's existence is tracked and then rated, so that you get some kind of a score, social credit score, about how compliant you are. And when you combine that,
compliant with the state or the party, with whatever the dictates,
right, exactly,
of your leader is.
Right. So in other words, in China, it would be how compliant of a communist Chinese citizen do you not make any waves. So if it came to America, it would be, you know, how compliant are you with whatever the current administration is trying to push? Like, how compliant are you with the vaccines? And it has recently come to light that that the World Health Organization has established new codes for people who are unvaccinated or only partially vaccinated. And these came in April of last year. Nobody knew about it. So they're tracking your vaccine status already. And if you are deemed to be non-compliant, then they can do things, especially if they are combined with a central bank digital currency, like shut you off from your credit cards, shut you off from your bank account.
Fire you, prevent you from getting food. I mean, the Chinese communists have shown this is an instrument for very brute repression, no?
Right, and you can't travel, your kid can't go, you can't borrow money to buy a house. I mean, they will completely shut you down. And so this is what is on the table here now with it coming to the United States, with the World Health Organization and the G20 are both calling for mandatory digital IDs, and they've already engaged Georgia Telecom to create these.
Wow. I'm old enough to remember there's been a long-running debate about national IDs. Before there was a digital feature to it, just the idea of having not state-issued driver's licenses, but some sort of national ID. And I think a lot of Americans found that repugnant, and so we haven't had it. But now they're talking about having external forces essentially imposing it upon us with the connivance of the Biden administration.
Right, so this is not just a national ID, this is an international ID.
Right.
These IDs are supposed to be interoperable.
Citizens of the world.
Right, and so what that means is that if it's attached to all of our information, which it will be, the Chinese Communist Party, for example, will have all of our information, including real-time geolocation. They'll know exactly where we are, our entire network of relationships, and also, facial recognition. It's actually quite frightening, and the Biden administration is also in the process of rolling out central bank digital currencies, so that if you have a central bank digital currency and no cash, if they want to shut you off, they can.
Very easily.
Yeah. Reggie, one of the other focuses of your efforts with the Stop Vax Passports effort team is raising questions about the vaccines and the idea of these mandates. And what you've just described is basically a vehicle for compelling compliance with whatever mandates and punishing you if you don't comply. Talk a little bit about what we've been learning about the perils associated with these vaccines. I've had them described on our program as actually weapons designed to kill or maim, especially working-aged people. And whether you ascribe that to the Chinese Communists or the globalists or some other group, is that your understanding, and are you
okay.
right?
So
be concerned about?
I am very concerned about the vaccines. I do not have the scientific credentials of Dr. Mike Yeadon, Dr. Sasha Lapitivova, Karen Kingston. These people are super experts, and they're the ones who are saying this is a bioweapon. So if they say it's a bioweapon, we need to really carefully consider that. But I do know, according to all kinds of various experts, that the injuries from the vaccines are being suppressed, including even on Facebook, where somebody says, "This is my story. I was injured," and it gets taken down as misinformation. All right. And then we've got the Twitter files saying that the government was actually trying to get social media to stop vaccine hesitancy, and they were paying money for it as well.
And suppress any criticism.
Right, suppressing criticism, and so we're not getting the full story, other than in a few places like stopvaxpassports.org. I think the Epic Times is good. I think LifeSite News is good. There are a few places.
Dr. Malone's Substack. Naomi Wolf, Daily Cloud.io.
Yeah, there's many places where you can get it, but they're alternative news sources.
They are alternative, and they face, to varying degrees, suppression from these powers. And I guess the point here is that this is headed in the wrong direction, that if we are not able to stop this effort to negotiate new arrangements, whether they're amendments to regulations that exist today or whether they're a new agreement of some kind, empowering the World Health Organization, which should be among the most discredited outfits in the world based on what they did to us in the last pandemic cycle. Just very quickly, Reggie, what can people do to resist this trajectory and hopefully correct it?
Well, the World Health Organization has basically set a trap for us, and they are bearing down on international health regulation amendments and also a new pandemic treaty, which will take away our sovereignty. We will give Dr. Tedros, the Director General of the World Health Organization, the ability, number one, to surveil us, and number two, to mandate what exactly is the response that the United States will have, including he could conceivably force mandates of vaccines, etc. So we need to go to stopvaxpassports.org, sign the petition against vaccine passports, and also urge Congress not to pass an increase to the debt ceiling unless we withdraw from the WHO.
Amen. Absolutely critical. Reggie, leadership. Thank you for your leadership. Reggie Littlejohn, Women's Rights Without Frontiers.org is where you can find out much more about her work, but also, of course, StopVaxPassports.org. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He is one of our favorites, one of the most impressive contributors, I think, to, well, the public policy debate about communist China, brought about in part by his long experience monitoring closely what the communist Chinese are up to, specifically in terms of the growing military capabilities, but also the ambitions and the larger agenda of global domination that the Chinese Communist Party has had as a sort of governing agenda, as well as the impetus behind so much of what they're doing in the way of unrestricted warfare against us. Our guest name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a career naval intelligence officer who completed his distinguished service as the chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He is now a civilian, which makes him at liberty to talk frankly about what he's witnessing, what he's making of it. And Captain Fennell, I'm always delighted to have you with us, but let me just start by saying how much I appreciate your steadfastness over the years and your willingness to speak the truth about what you see going on here, despite all of the efforts made to discourage truth-telling. So welcome back, sir. Good to have you here at Securing America once again.
Well, thanks for those kind remarks, Frank, and it's good to be with you and your audience again.
Thank you. I want to mention that, Jim, I got a couple of different angles that I want to take with you on this, but in part because recently a Rear Admiral by the name of Michael Studeman, and I don't know if you know him personally, but he probably was a shipmate of yours at one point, now Chief of Naval Intelligence for the entire United States Navy, expressed in a public statement something that sounded an awful lot like you, if I recall correctly, back when you were in uniform, saying, what's going on here? Why are we not connecting the dots? Don't we understand that the Chinese Communist Party is preparing for the old-fashioned kind of war? And I wondered, as you watched Admiral Studeman making those remarks, what went through your mind and what we all should take away from it.
Well, Frank, I have known Mike for almost 30 years. We served in the Pacific together. He was at the U.S. Pacific Command when I was at the Pacific Fleet the first time. And what Mike said in this recent speech that he gave down at the in San Diego at the Armed Forces Communication Electronics Association and U.S. Naval Institute conference, they call WEST, he basically said, you know, America's not aware of the threat. And why is that? Or he didn't actually ask the second part. He just said, America's not aware of the threat, which leads us to why is that? And so we could probably go down that road. But I think what Mike said is something that, as you noted, I've been saying for quite a long time and actually said at West in 2013 and 2014 and had different results and reception 10 years ago than Mike got this time. So I'm happy that Mike said
that.
Well,
to put a fine point on it, as I recall, you were cashiered by the Navy for expressing those concerns at the time. And just give us a bit of the context why that was, Mike. Excuse me, Mike is on my mind, but Jim Fennell, why is it that your message was so badly received at the time? And I'm not sure it's being well received at this juncture, but at least he's not being cashiered as a result.
Well, I think we're seeing, I mean, I can go back even another 10 years before when I arrived at the Hoover Institution in Stanford in 2005 after a tour out in Japan aboard the USS Kitty Hawk as the senior intel officer for that carrier strike group. And I came back to what is, you know, conservative think tank. And I was really shocked that this mostly Reaganite group of people that had served honorably in the Reagan administration were largely unaware of what China was doing. It wasn't that they weren't receptive, they just were unaware. That was in 2005. And then by 2014, when I retired, the awareness was growing, but there was an institutional bias against talking about it because we had been so invested as a nation in wars in the Middle East. And I think what we're seeing now after the pullout in Afghanistan is that people are starting to now be able to shift focus and say, OK, now I can focus on this. It's kind of disappointing to think that in the Cold War, the United States was able to confront the Soviet Union and deal with the Soviets in terms of land power and naval power. And so we were able to sustain a large army presence in Europe while also having a global Navy that could confront the Soviet Navy in the Pacific and elsewhere. And we were able to, you know, basically do both elements of what I would call the sound military deterrence and defense policies. And we got away from that for 30 years by focusing in on land warfare and, you know, special operations in the Middle East for right reasons, but we lost our focus and our thinking to think ahead, to play the long game, the term some people use. And so we walked away from that, and now we're trying to catch up. But what we're finding is, unlike being able to ramp up a military to find individual terrorists like Osama bin Laden, which we could rapidly do, it's much more difficult to ramp up a nation to find and fight the Chinese that is a peer competitor in naval warfare and major theater warfare that will incur in the Far East, in the Indo-Pacific. And so we are finding ourselves woefully behind, which means we should have been paying attention to those warnings 10 years ago and 20 years ago. And we know some individuals that were warning 30 years ago, back in the early 90s during the Clinton administration. So we've had prophets of warning in the U.S. system, but they were ignored. And so I'm glad that Mike's doing this now, but we need much, much more. We need more than just warning. We need action.
I couldn't agree more. Interestingly, we're speaking to you on the day that I think there's been a new poll released. I'm not sure who conducted it, but I'm told that only 15% of Americans, a level not seen since the Tiananmen Square massacre, now view China, and I think by that we mean the Chinese Communist Party that rules it, in a favorable light. I'm hard-pressed to think why it's even that large a number, unless that's basically the captured elite that we're talking about, all, you know, that have come about as a result of Chinese unrestricted warfare operations. But Jim Fennell, is this a case, do you think, where the public may be ahead of our government in perceiving, with notable exceptions, as we've been just talking about, perceiving China as a threat, the Chinese Communist Party specifically as a mortal peril? And while they may not know, the American people more generally, all the details that you do, or even have a clue as to what they want done about it, at least they're now perceiving this with a clarity that has been missing. And you mentioned, if I could just quickly as an aside, that we were too invested in Middle East wars. I thought what you were going to say was we were too invested in the idea that if we just made the Chinese richer, they would be benign and ultimately more like us. Walk us through where you think we are at the moment, governmentally, as well as in terms of public attitudes.
Well, I think in terms of our overarching government policy, it was one of benign neglect in terms of being focused on the Middle East. But you're certainly correct to say that our Wall Street and Silicon Valley also saw that as an opportunity, a big hole through the line, if you will, and they ran through it to be able to say, I'm going to make money. And so that's what we've been doing in engaging, you know, from a diplomatic State Department standpoint. We thought engagement with the Chinese would mediate any of the concerns that we'd have about dealing with the Communist Party of China. That's all turned out to be incorrect, and that we're now facing, as you mentioned, a mortal and lethal threat. And the fact that 15%, or I would look at it the other way, to say 85% of Americans now recognize that the PRC is a threat, for me is a good thing to see, because 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we didn't have that awareness. So I think in some sense, we do have Americans that recognize it. My concern is that it'll be twisted back by those that are, as you mentioned, the elite capture, those within the government that have had a vested interest in engaging with the PRC and with the Chinese Communist Party. They're going to turn this on, and I've already seen it in some networks and some groups that I'm associated with that I follow, that they're already talking about, well, this is really terrible because it's just a reflection of American xenophobia and racism towards Asians. And so I think it's really important that you've been very clear, and just in this discussion, but as always, that we're not talking about Chinese people. We're talking about the Chinese Communist Party, about communism, about the ideology of communism that stands directly opposed to this values and principles that are enshrined in our Constitution about our basic human rights and Bill of Rights that were given to us by God and that are applicable to any nation around the world, to include the Chinese people.
Right. This is such a key point, Captain Fennell, that we often overlook. Those very qualities about our country, about our republic, about our values, about our system, are anathema to the Chinese Communist Party and communists everywhere. And therefore, I think all the more reason why they are determined to crush us so as to advance their design for assuring that their values, their system, their control dominates in its stead. We'll talk a little bit more about how that's being advanced in a variety of ways with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired, on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Marx Brothers had a famous routine in which when they were engaged in an obvious flim-flam, an incredulous observer was asked, "Who you gonna believe, me or your own eyes?" That question occurs in the wake of a congressional hearing on Tuesday examining whether the so-called COVID-19 virus came from nature or was genetically engineered in a laboratory in Wuhan, China, tied to the CCP's illegal biological warfare program. Every witness agreed that the lab origin hypothesis is not some off-the-wall conspiracy theory. Indeed, yesterday's testimony establishes what your own eyes can clearly see. Dr. Tony Fauci was spending taxpayer money at the Wuhan Institute of Virology to pay for the sort of genetic modifications to coronaviruses found in the original COVID-1. He lied to cover that up and must be held accountable for doing so. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with the great Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, former Chief of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, one of the most clear-eyed, well, national security professionals I know when it comes especially to the threat we face from the Chinese Communist Party. We've been talking with him a bit about how we got into the fix we're in now, where warnings by him and others heretofore have not been heeded properly. And as a result, the Chinese have, well, as they say in the military, stolen a march on us in a variety of ways. Jim, one of which is in terms of the mobilization of their industrial capabilities, which are really astonishingly vast now. They have a whole of society, civil military fusion design. And as that has been applied, it is bounded to, among other things, enormous investments in shipbuilding capabilities. I'd be interested in your thoughts. You've talked about them a little bit here before in terms of the comparative size of their shipbuilding assets and what remains of ours. But if you would, talk more broadly about the entire mobilization capability of this country, whether it's the shipyards themselves, the production of combatants for the Navy, whether it's even the ports, which the Wall Street Journal reports we now have Chinese cranes all over that may or may not work should we need them, particularly to move not just, you know, cargo, but also military deployments overseas. Give us a sit rep on that, if you would.
Well, Frank, this last week as the China is having the Communist Party holding the National People's Congress, which they do every March. It's a two-week event, two sessions, they call it. And they announced here that here in the last 48 hours that they're going to increase spending on the PLA by 7.2% compared to last year. And last year it was an increase of 7.1%. Year before that, 6.8, and then before that, 6.6. And I go back those 4 years because in 2020 was the first year that during the National People's Congress that the Chinese Communist Party could not forecast their domestic gross production increase for that year of 2020. They'd never failed to give a projection. And in 2020, they did, but they were still able to tell us that they would increase spending on the PLA by 6.6%.
Now, just say a word about this, you know, how real these numbers are. They say it's going to take it up to $200 billion or something like that, which they point out is a tiny fraction of what the United States spends. What are the real numbers? What are the implications of that kind of steady growth?
Right. I think we can get lost in the numbers themselves. I mean, but roughly they spend this year, they're going to spend, they say, about $230 billion compared to $800 billion for the United States. So roughly, they'll spend one quarter of what we'll spend, at least publicly announced, yet they'll get five times as much production out of their, just in the naval arena, they'll produce five times as many warships and submarines and aircraft, naval aircraft, than the United States Navy will. So that's really the bottom line for me, is what is produced.
Yeah, so what are the implications of that, Jim? You've studied their ship, you know, comparisons with ours for decades. Well, is that a sustainable situation for us?
It's not a sustainable situation, especially when we're having significant problems with lack of shipyards, a kind of a production process for the U.S. Navy that seems to not be able to produce ships that are capable of meeting mission requirements. So we've had three failed U.S. Navy production lines. One, the littoral combat ship, which has not really worked out. It's been a disaster, as you say. We've had the Zumwalt-class cruiser or advanced destroyer, but it's really a cruiser size. There's only three of them, and it doesn't have a weapon to be able to shoot another ship. And then you have the Ford-class nuclear-powered aircraft carrier with the electromagnetic aircraft launch system that is 5 years behind schedule and still hasn't been fully released to the operational combatant commanders. It's still under the control of the Chief of Naval Operations. So we've failed to produce, for instance, in the last decade, we've produced this one Ford-class carrier that's fraught with problems, still hasn't made an operational deployment, and the PRC have launched and put three aircraft carriers in the water. Now, two of them are operational. One will be operational by the end of this year. They've also done the same thing with these large amphibious helicopter carriers, the Type 075. They've launched now, I think, three or four of them. They're going to produce eight of them. Six of them are already built, and they're getting ready to be put in the water. They're marching forward with the creation of their own carrier strike groups, expeditionary strike groups. And I was just looking before we talked today, we talk about logistics, fleet logistics. We have 18 Henry J. Kaiser class oilers, fleet oilers, that supply our Navy the ability to operate around the globe. Well, China has 12 right now, and they're producing more. So they're on track to produce the kinds of numbers and capabilities to have a global Navy. And their ships today are in many ways superior to ours when it comes to the function of war at sea, which is what the U.S. Navy, when I joined up, was all about, fighting the Soviet Navy at sea. And we've gotten away from that.
Yeah. Gosh, there's so much to unpack there, Jim. I guess the main point for me is that we have now serious issues with respect to both the quantity and the quality of naval assets that the Chinese and we are respectively bringing to bear. And that is, I've got to believe, further tempting the Chinese Communist Party to believe that it can, with impunity, engage in aggression against us or our friends and allies at a minimum, but in vital interests as well. Again, you've seen this coming. You've done your best to warn of it for many years. It's catching up with us now, and the implications of it are extremely concerning. We have one more break to take, Jim. We're going to ask you to stay with us for another segment and talk a bit about how this is now translating into policy in China and what we best be doing to counter it. That and more with the great Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, right after this. Stay with us. We're back. Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired, is aboard, I'm very pleased to say, and we've been having a bracing, if very troubling, conversation with him to this point about sort of the current state of the United States Navy, particularly relative to its Chinese counterpart. And I wanted to talk to you for a brief moment, Jim, at least, about the context in which this is taking place. Not only is there this announced further buildup of the Chinese military, but we've had their new foreign minister, until recently the U.S., the ambassador to the United States by the name of Qin Gang, talking about conflict between our two countries being, quote, inevitable, unquote, if the United States doesn't change course in what he described as its efforts to contain, encircle, and subvert, I believe, the Chinese Communist Party. Suppress, not subvert, I guess. What did you make of this speech or this comment at a press conference earlier this week, Jim?
Yeah, Frank, I would say that the foreign minister's statements are consistent with the Chinese Communist Party's longstanding attitude towards the United States. They see us as the sole obstacle to their achievement of the great rejuvenation and positioning of China as the center of the universe, if you will, at least the center of the universe on the planet Earth, that they're going to be the arbiters of the global economy, the global politics, global diplomacy, rule setting, things of that nature. And so the United States is the only country that can prevent them from achieving their goals. And their goals seek to enslave the world under the Chinese Communist Party in a collective. And we stand for individual liberty and freedom, and they can't allow that to exist. And so they're using diplomacy, which is what the foreign minister is, a diplomat. They're using his bully pulpit to shape the strategic narrative, the strategic communications plan of the Chinese Communist Party, to characterize the United States as the bully, as the aggressor, when in fact we know that it's the Chinese Communist Party that's aggressor, is the aggressor in Asia today. They're the ones that are flying across the center line in the Taiwan Strait. They're the ones that are entering Chinese or the Taiwan Air Defense Identification Zone multiple times on a daily basis. They're the ones that are sending their aircraft carriers, their nuclear submarines surrounding Taiwan, sailing to the east of Taiwan, threatening them. They're also doing the same thing to Japan. They're doing threatening actions against India. They've killed Indian soldiers a couple of years ago. They're brutal and thuggish against the nations of the South China Sea to take possession of those disputed territories. So China is the aggressor. China is the one that inflicted the virus on the world and killed 7 million people. China is the one that's using economic warfare to retaliate against South Korea if they allowed a U.S. Anti-missile defense battery to be put on the Korean Peninsula. China is the aggressor in every form and every realm of military, and or not military, but the statecraft. They're the ones that are the aggressors, yet they'll come out in the diplomacy and say, it's inevitable we'll have conflict because America's threatening us. America's not threatening China. America hasn't surrounded China. In fact, we just pulled out of a base 2 years ago in Afghanistan that would, if anybody wanted to promote that theory, why would we pull out of Bagram if we were surrounding China? And how come we haven't greatly increased our naval and air and marine presence and army presence in the Indo-Pacific? So we haven't really done any of the things that they've said, but they're using these words to lay the foundation. And I can recall, over the last decade, especially more 10 years ago, the Chinese naval forces and air forces would come on the radio and tell our forces, you will suffer the consequences. You will suffer the consequences. So this is the demeanor and language that the Chinese Communist Party uses. And for all of us that were grade school children, we know what that is. It's a bully. It's a grade school bully that just pushes people around.
And unless and until they're stopped, they will continue to become more and more aggressive. And this brings me to just a quick plug, if I can, Jim, for a book that we've produced drawing upon the 70 plus webinars that our Committee on the Present Danger China, of which I'm very proud you are a member, has performed over the past, 7 or 8 months, I guess. A number of them with your considerable contribution, by the way. We call it the indictment. And it's intended to be a way of thinking about the Chinese Communist Party that can become hopefully a rallying point for all of that concern we talked about earlier, now public concern and hopefully increasingly governmental concern and action, by prosecuting the case against what is a transnational criminal organization, the Chinese Communist Party. I say prosecuted at least in the court of public opinion, with a view to indicting and holding accountable and punishing the Chinese for their crimes against humanity, notably against their own people, but as you've indicated, what they have in mind for the rest of us as well. And what I think are war crimes against us, the product of those unrestricted warfare strategies, economic, political, elite capture, information operations, energy warfare, subversion, you name it, have taken a horrific toll, as you understand better than probably anybody. So the idea here is to both lay out 9 charges against the CCP and recommend 20 specific steps that can now be taken, must now be taken, both to try to right the ship, as they would say in the Navy, to protect our people against what's coming, quite possibly, and also to penalize the Chinese Communist Party for their predations. So watch this space. We hope it's at the publisher now. We hope to have it out very shortly. And Jim, you'll be getting one of the first copies of it. But I'd so appreciate what you've done to inform it as well as inform this program and audience. And we'll look forward to having you back very soon to do more of it, because this is topic A, I think, for those of us who care about freedom and preserving our nation. Godspeed, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Thanks to all of you for joining us for this edition. Come back to us next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.